All right, this week we've got a lot of good stories to talk about, like every week. But I really am excited to get to some of these. I want to begin with a little bit of a follow-up. We mentioned the new HomeKit secure video feature coming to HomeKit video cameras this fall. That's the feature that uses existing iCloud storage if you have is it 200 gigabyte or 2 terabyte plan?
Maybe? Yeah, if you have 200 gigabytes, you can save clips from one camera. And if you have the 2 terabyte plan, you can save clips from up to 5 cameras.
Okay. And it saves clips for like the last, 10 days?
Yeah, but it doesn't save the entire day's worth of video. If it detects motion, it will store those clips. Yeah.
Yeah. And it processes the motion detection on a HomePod, Apple TV, or iPad. So the question was, which cameras will support this? And we've seen some stories, like I think you covered one that the ProLine HomeKit doorbell will support this, which wasn't part of the keynote. The keynote at WWDC 2019 mentioned support from Logitech, Eufy, and Natatmo. So there was still a question, though, of like which Logitech cameras will work. And last Friday, there was a community forum post from Logitech that said, Camera 2 wired cameras will support HomeKit secure video with a free firmware update later this year. Stay tuned for more details. And I think it was like unsolicited, or maybe somebody asked about it, but like it was definitely a post from Logitech. And with all like always with HomeKit stuff and like firmware updates, it's always like we'll believe it when we see it.
Yeah, it always takes longer than they say it will.
Yeah, but at least Logitech is promising to try and support the feature on existing cameras that they already sell. And the Logi Circle 2 has been like, it only works with the wired version, not the wireless version, which is kind of a bummer. But that's the version I've got, is the wired version. I've got 3 of those because I like it that much. And I recommend those to people because they're really small and they work really well. So I like those. So maybe 3 of my, I think I've got 5 HomeKit cameras will work with the feature this fall.
Yeah, assuming there's no new announcements from any other company by the time this stuff actually ships, which could be 2020 realistically, sure, given the timescale of HomeKit firmware updates. But I would definitely be interested in picking up some of the Logitech cameras because they seem like the best at the moment, and obviously they're the only ones officially announced for the new iCloud video saving. The doorbell was interesting because on the stage, it wasn't entirely clear if it was only going to be like standalone cameras or they include other stuff as well. And even the doorbell, like the ProLine doorbell from Robin, is the only HomeKit doorbell that actually on sale at the moment at all, full stop.
Right.
So and they haven't given a time frame either. They just said later this year. But they sent me one, so I actually have the doorbell now. And it's not set up yet, but hopefully when it is, I can talk about it a bit more. And obviously, I'm not in a rush because it's going to be like at least 3 months until the firmware update's ready anyway, but it'll still be cool. Yeah.
Is that the one that's crazily priced?
Yeah, it's like $600, something ridiculous.
Right, yeah. Which even like $200 for like a video doorbell is like, okay, I guess so, but $600 is nuts. All right. So my other two cameras, I've got the D-Link Omna 180 HD, and that was like the only reason that I have that is because it was the very first HomeKit video camera to come out. And it uses, I think, a micro SD card for storing the footage, which is interesting. And I think Natatmo does that too. So it seems like that won't be an issue. And then I've got the baby monitor camera. I forget who makes that, but it's packed with sensors. So I like that. All right, let's move on. This week, we got lots of new betas. So there's iOS 13 beta 2, and then beta 2 versions of iPadOS 13, watchOS 6, macOS Catalina, tvOS 13. Am I forgetting anything?
I think that's right.
Okay. So one of the first things that we saw that's new is that the high key mono portrait mode filter is now in this beta, and kind of describe what that portrait mode filter is.
So it's like the stage light mono that existed before, except rather than being on a black background, it's on a white background.
So you're black and white, and the stage light mono one, they've got stage light, which blacks out your background, but you're in color. And then they've got stage light mono, which blacks out the background, and then you're black and white. And then this one is you're black and white, and the background's white. So we need a video of like using this, like from a screen recording from the iPhone. And I got to use the crop video feature that you mentioned before, that like, it's useful for this purpose of like taking a screen recording from the iPhone and like making it the right orientation. But you can see like the effect going in and out from like the viewfinder of the camera. So I jokingly call it like the Johnny Ives white room filter, because it whites out everything behind you. I just wish it would support color too, because I think that'd be pretty cool.
So I have like you in color and then the background white.
Yeah, just like the stage light filter does.
Yeah.
Not the mono version. I think that'd be cool.
Yeah, I mean, in general, the stage light portrait lighting effects are generally the worst out of the bunch, just because
they
actually do the most processing in terms of what they actually fully cut out your body against the background. It also exposes them to being the ones where it's most obvious that the algorithms haven't worked properly and there's obvious flaws, especially when you're using like the Face ID camera, not the rear camera as well. It's, you know, you just see like the weird cutouts of the hair, and it's not a smooth line. It's like a weird jag and stuff. So in general, they're not the greatest, but they definitely have got better than when they first launched. Because when they first launched, they were really bad, and I think they did some like algorithm improvements, and it got better. And based on pictures that other people have taken, like you, of the Hikey Mono, I actually think the Hikey Mono, the white one, looks better than the black one. It just, I don't know, it just looks more modern.
Yeah, it does. It pops well. I like it too. There is a weird device limitation. Like you mentioned, it's more computational, but so far in beta 2, like it wasn't in beta 1, it was announced at the keynote, it's in beta 2 for the iPhone XS, XR, and XS Max, I believe, but not the iPad Pros from 2018 that have the same processors, which I don't understand. Like if it's a limitation, it's those iPads have Face ID on the front camera, so they do portrait mode filters and photos. And so I don't understand why they don't have that yet. Maybe
I'm on an iPhone X, so I didn't get it either. You know, my phone in the future.
and do you get the stage light filters?
Yeah, I get stage light. The iPhone XR does not get stage light.
Really? Okay. So
yeah, it only gets the first three.
Okay, so it probably doesn't get the new one either. I kind of get the 10, like if they're going to cut off devices. I do not understand the iPad because it has the same processor.
iPad seemed maybe like an oversight, and they'll get to it.
Because
the iPhone 10 didn't get the portrait, the blur adjustment either, the blur slider, focus control, whatever they call it. Mm-hmm. So that hasn't been, that's, we've already been behind on like the whole portrait mode effects already. But
yeah,
I feel like I need an explanation for why a white version of the black and white filter is not supported on, like, is it too taxing on the A11 CPU to, you know, make something render a white background instead of a black background? Like, I don't really get the difference in complexity there. It seems it's the exact same filter, just changing the colors slightly.
Yeah, my joke to you was I'm surprised your iPhone 10 can even run light mode since it's just changing the color. All right. Also new in this beta for iOS 13 and iPadOS 13 is SMB server connectivity in the Files app. What is SMB server connectivity? I know we discussed it before, but explain, like, when I hear, I think when I see SMB, I think of small and medium businesses. What's SMB server connectivity in the Files app?
I can't remember off the top of my head what it stands for, but it's essentially the standard file system, networked file system protocol for...
I think it's server meshes block.
Oh, really? How'd you work that one out? so basically everything, every like computery device that exposes files to the network is generally using SMB, because Apple used to have one called AFP, but they've basically like deprecated it, and all Macs now default to like SMB, and your Synology, for instance, will be SMB, and... Mm-hmm. All the Windows computers. Basically, you know when you go in the Finder and then you see like other computers on this network?
Yeah.
Basically, every single one of those connections is going to be SMB. So, on your iOS device now, iPhone or iPad, on beta 2, if you're connected to the local network and you know the name of the server, you can type it in and connect.
Okay, so you tap like the more button where you scan documents, edit the page, or connect to server is the new option. And then you've got to type in the server URL.
Which will be something like SMB:// blah, 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 blah. Unlike the Mac Finder, for some reason, it doesn't just show you the names of the stuff on the local network, which seems like a bit of an oversight, considering, you know, iOS is meant to be the easy platform. Why are they making you manually type in the name of it? I'm not really sure.
I don't but even it does know where work. I find the name of my server.
Yes, that's half the battle. Like for a Synology, you might have to go in and change a setting and make it like public. You know, there's configuration options and stuff that get in the way, but you theoretically should be able to type in, if you do file sharing of your iMac, you should be able to get your iMac's files through the Files app on the phone as well.
Yeah, that's cool. I like that idea. And being able to like access from my iPhone or iPad files on my Synology for the first time is pretty cool. I already, like, for the most part, my Synology is used for Plex, and then the Plex client is just like, it shows up everywhere. Like, it's just on every single device in the world. And so it just like finds all the media that way. But I've also, I guess I do use part of this Synology for like, here's a big bunch of files, you know, that I just want to put over here. So then I can get to that now.
I just wish they would add like a list of the local networks that it can detect anyway, because otherwise,
just like the Mac.
Yeah, just like the Mac. Yeah, otherwise you're just making you go through hoops for no reason. So
iOS 13 also adds in beta 2 a new warning when you unsubscribe from subscription apps. So if you have an active subscription, like to Netflix, for example, and you delete the app, the old problem was you would continue to pay for that subscription even if you didn't want to. Now you get a warning upon deleting the app that says, you know, I guess, by the way, you still subscribe to this app. It made me think, like, I was billed one time for Showtime through the TV app, and there's no deleting the TV app, or I guess you could hide it, but there's no like deleting like the Showtime app in that case, because it's part of the TV app. I'm not sure that it's easy to manage that on the Apple TV, but that warning is nice for app based subscriptions. But if it's in the TV app, you just gotta set a reminder for those trials or subscriptions.
Yeah, I still think they could go further on the whole, you know, because the whole point is it feels like Apple's kind of benefiting from, you know, like gray practice of, oh, people are just forgetting to renew their subscriptions, and it's kind of slimy, and it's, you know, it's not really something you expect from, you know, the premium brands like Apple Incorporated, the biggest company
in
the world.
And you're not like building your subscription services business on people forgetting. Like, there is like residual bump from that, I guess, but it's not from the same people, you know, because eventually you catch on. It's like, 3 months of this, I'm going to cancel it however I do that. You know?
Yeah. And so the status quo, obviously, in all shipping devices today is you can go into an app, start a 7-day trial, then decide you don't like the app anymore, delete the app, and then just forget that you ever started a trial, and then immediately get billed in 7 days' time. And that was obviously bad, and that led to a load of, you know, scam apps. Like, we covered one on the show before, you know, like the one that was saying, oh, it can read your fingerprint to find out, you know, your heart rate or whatever, and it just showed the in-app purchase pop-up, and people would subscribe to a subscription before they even realized what was going on. And then, you know, if you're an average customer, your knee-jerk reaction is, oh, I don't want this anymore, I'll just delete the app. But obviously, that doesn't delete the subscription that goes along with it. It doesn't make sense from Apple's side to cancel a subscription upon deleting the app directly, because you might have apps like Netflix, where if you subscribe in the app, you don't want to cancel your Netflix subscription just because you deleted the app on your phone. You might still want to access the service on, you know, your Android devices, your Apple TV, your Mac, all the other places. But giving the warning is a nice step in the right direction. And I think the warning says something like, your subscription to this app can still be used on other devices. It will renew on this date, which is nice. So it actually gives you a time frame of when the next renewal is coming up. And then there's a link to keep you just carry on as normal, or it can take you to the subscription screen, which is, you know, reasonably buried in the system to actually find the list of everything of your active subscriptions and you know, filter them out from there. I think eventually it would be nice if they had something proactive for when you do start. It's mainly the trials that cause the problem, because it's like, oh, you set a 30-day trial, which Apple actively encourages. They really want people to do like introductory offers and trials and stuff. They keep promoting it. It's just then the time runs out and you get billed without. I feel like there should be a notification as your first renewal of the free trial expires, if that makes sense. So if you subscribe to like a 7-day trial or something, on like the 6th day, your phone could show a notification on the lock screen. This app's free trial is expiring. You'll be billed, you know, this month per month from tomorrow, just to give you that extra prompt that you want to make the logical decision as a customer. It just gives the customer and the user the control to actually be aware and conscious of what they're actually spending, and you don't have the dumb purchases where stuff gets spent erratically without them knowing. And then they call up iTunes support and iTunes support tells them they can't help them, and everyone gets mad and sad. And, you know, like, it's just ethical business practice, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Also new in iOS 13 beta 2 release this week is are a couple of changes to CarPlay. So we mentioned last week that there was a new Now Playing icon for CarPlay, and there wasn't like a new layout or anything yet. This week they changed our beautiful blue Now Playing icon to a white icon with like a red and pink Play logo on it. I really like the Now Playing like button in apps, because it's like, if it's not playing, you get like sound waves in the shape of like the play icon, like the triangle.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are playing, then they animate like a Now Playing indicator would, you know, with like the sound bars moving up and down. I just loved the blue icon. We mentioned before that like on the watch they had a white one. We hope that maybe the watch would get the blue one. No, they all turn white in the end. So that's too bad. But it also comes along with a new Now Playing screen layout, which the old way was the track title and artist and track title is on one line and centered, and the artist and album are on the next line, and the artwork is in the background, but kind of blurry, like it's like masked with like a layer of blur, so that it's not, doesn't cover up anything. Now they've added artwork. You still get the background blurry artwork, but you also get a square with the artwork that's very clear on the right side, and to the left of that, like the artwork is like 1/3 of the screen. To the left of that is like 2/3 dedicated to the track title and the track artist and album, and then like the play controls. The problem with that is any track that's like more than a few words gets truncated, and it doesn't scroll. Even if it scrolled, it wouldn't be great because only using 2/3 of like the width of that screen is only ideal on the widescreen CarPlay screens, and those aren't very common.
Yeah, but all of the changes in iOS 13 seem to assume that widescreen CarPlay displays are really common, like all of the redesigns and stuff. And they, you know, for the most part, it's really good on everything, but they definitely shine on, you know, widescreen CarPlay devices, and that's what Apple keeps showing in all of its marketing as well. They always show the super, super wide ones, but, you know, they're like gold dust in the real world.
Yes. And so, you know, for the title track, you get truncation often, and there's no scrolling. So it's just, you know, like our show title last week is WWDC 2019 impression, ... And with songs, I've seen the same thing. Like if it's more than like four words and it's going to truncate. The next line, I don't know how anything can fit there unless it's just like one artist name, no album. So 9 to 5 happy hour, June 7th, 2019 becomes 9 to 5 Mac HAP ... June 7th, 2019. And then like, any band name with an artist it's going to be like part of the band name ... and then part of the album name. And it's just not legible. So I really hope they reconsider this. I didn't notice, but this was the Now Playing design they had on stage at the keynote for WWDC 2019. So I guess this was in the works. Obviously, this was in the works before last week, you know. But I really think they need to consider something here.
Well, either they should dynamically hide the album art if you're on a non-super wide screen, or at the very least, they should have the text scroll and not just straight truncate.
Yeah, because truncation was an issue even before the album art was there. It's just way worse now.
Yeah, and the music app on the iPhone and iPad, obviously, it does scroll.
Yeah, I don't love scrolling text. Like, if you're driving it, you know, it's a little bit distracting. And also, like, if you've got to scroll everything, but you've got this big screen with empty space around it, it just feels like misuse of space. Like, maybe put the album, maybe, like, use 3 lines instead of 2 lines. You know, there's room for that. But anyway, that's in beta 2. So we'll have to look and see how that changes in the future. Let's see. What else do we get? We get changes with... Oh, I want to say a few more things about CarPlay. This week, I had an experience where I was using the new ETA feature that we discussed last week. And your experience is that you can share from the Maps app on the iPhone and always pick who the contact is to share your ETA with. But then in CarPlay, you can't. It's just recommendations. So the first thing I want to say is that I was navigating to a contact's address, but it's not someone who I had messaged with like often over the last few days. I did say like, hey, on the way. But I couldn't use the ETA function from CarPlay because it wasn't intelligent. It doesn't say, oh, that's a contact in your database. You're going there. Let me recommend that person. And I'm going to follow feedback on that because I think that's very obvious. And then also follow feedback on the inability to add a contact from CarPlay. I couldn't even do it from the iPhone though. Like, I think it might have been bugged out, but I was like, I'll just use the iPhone as a workaround, using your tutorial on how to do it. So
yeah, you can. I mean, when it's not broken, you can definitely do it from the phone because on CarPlay it only shows recent contacts, but on the phone it shows recent contacts plus just an arbitrary add button that just goes to your address book.
Yeah. So. That's what I got. And then I just tried like what happens if you use Waze or Google Maps. Do you get the map on the dashboard feature where you get like, you know, your widgets for now playing and some calendar and Siri suggestions and then like the current map that you're on. And it doesn't work yet. Maybe it will in the future.
What does it show instead?
It shows your location on Apple Maps. As a dot that just travels. So
yeah, I think that's a short-term thing. That kind of sucks if that is just the status quo.
Right. I have a feeling it'll shift like that, and then like they'll do like a point update one day or next version, like iOS 14. But like I saw one time where the dashboard map of like your current location or like your route that you're on took it needed to load before it appeared, and when it's dead, it's just like there's nothing to show there. It's just like the maps icon in a rectangle. So it's like an extension of the Maps app. And so I wonder if there's even support yet for apps to integrate when iOS 15 comes out, or if that's something they'll have to share in the future, like use it their own for 1 year and then share it with the developers the next year, kind of thing.
Everyone has that anxiety about missing their flight when it's time to actually get up and go. This week's sponsor, Clear, can help make the process of airport travel easier. Clear is simple. You can go right into security with a tap of your fingers, getting to your gate even faster and reducing that pre-flight stress. Clear replaces the need for physical ID cards. You can just use your eyes or fingertips to get through security. The Clear kiosks are available in more than 40 airports across the United States. New locations are being added all the time. It's not just airports either. They have Clear pods at sports stadiums now too, so you can get into the venue, relax, and grab some food before the game starts. To get signed up for Clear, make an account online before going to the airport. Once you arrive, a Clear ambassador helps you finish your enrollment. No appointment is required, and it takes less than 5 minutes. Then you can immediately use Clear for your flight and any journeys in the future. For families, up to 3 family members can be added at a discounted rate, and kids under 18 are free when traveling with a Clear member. It works great with TSA PreCheck too. In that case, Clear handles identity verification so you can walk directly to the security bins without hassle. Clear is the absolute best way to get through airport security. Right now, listeners of Happy Hour can get their first 2 months of Clear for free. Go to clearme.com/happyhour and use the code happyhour when you buy. That's clearme.com/happyhour. And remember to use the promo code happyhour to get your first free 2 months of Clear.
Changes in watchOS 6. There aren't many, especially that we can see yet. But tell me what's coming in watchOS 6, we believe, this fall.
Yeah, so TechCrunch reported that, and I think they were like talking to Apple or something, that by the time that watchOS 6 comes out to the public, you will actually be able to delete the stock apps, which is, it sounds like, at first I was like, wait, can't you do that? And it's like, no, that's what you could do on the phone for a while. So like, for a while you couldn't do it on the phone either. And then there's the big hoo-ha about Apple forcing stock apps on you. So their first kind of line of like compensation or compromise was to let you hide the apps on the iPhone. And then a couple of years later, they actually let you delete them for real and they'd actually save space. But on the watch, that hasn't been possible. If you deleted the Stocks app, where the stock, the companion Stocks app on the watch would go away because they're like paired together. But obviously on the watch, there are loads of stock apps that do not have, you know, iPhone parallels. Even like the clock app on the iPhone is split up into what, like stopwatch, timer, alarms, world clock. Like, yeah, so it has like 4 separate apps for what is one app on the phone. And so those would, they just wouldn't be deletable. And you can't even hide them, right? If you're on a honeycomb grid. There's a lot of icons, and watchOS 6 adds even more icons because they add quite a lot of stock apps. You have like the App Store, audiobooks, calculator, cycle tracking, noise, and voice memos, like loads of apps, right? So the problem was kind of getting a bit unbearable, but apparently by the time that WatchOS 6 comes out for real, most of the stock apps will be deletable. Obviously, you'll have the core apps like Messages or, you know, like the clock face that aren't deletable. That's the same on the phone as well. There's, you know, there are some stock apps that can't be deleted because they have, you know, ties into the actual like core system. But all of the, you know, ancillary stuff, including all of the different clock derivatives, can all be deleted at your leisure when WatchOS 6 ships for real. I'm quite happy about this because, you know, I'm a man. I don't need like the cycle tracking app. And it's also a white icon, so it really annoys me that there's a white icon that, you know, isn't even useful to me. So I can delete stuff like that. The Breathe app I never really use. I can probably get rid of that. So I'm happy that this is, you know, at least on its way, but it definitely doesn't work in the current seeds.
Right, right. Yep. And also last week I mentioned, you know, experience using the new watch faces in WatchOS 6. And I wondered if like the California face or the solar analog face, if solar dial, like if those have versions for the non series 4 watches. So every other watch besides the series 4. And it turns out the answer is that that's no, there's not even like a circular version with no complications. They just don't do those, just like they don't do Infograph and Infograph modular for those faces or any of the, like the full screen faces. So what you get if you have an old Apple Watch with WatchOS 6 is numerals. What is it? Mono and Duo.
Mm-hmm.
The titles, yeah. So you get two new watch faces and the biggest watch face update since the original WatchOS. So even more reason to upgrade to an Apple Watch Series 4 or this fall Series 5, we assume. So there's that. There's some new stuff with HomePod. There's a new pairing method that you can – it's part of iOS 13. So how does that work?
Yeah, so it uses – traditionally, the HomePod has done the audio tone setup system where the iPhone hears – the HomePod plays a few like noises and the iPhone hears it and pairs together. Failing that, it just asks you to type in a code that the HomePod reads out if it's like a noisy environment. But it seems like now they're transitioning to a visual pairing method where you like hold the phone over the top of the HomePod's, you know, LED display and it pairs that way, which is how they do it for like the Apple Watch, you know, as that, you know, that weird.
Well, sort of. It's good. Yeah, the Apple Watch has like the super cool like high, because it's a display, like it's got the super cool like planet or whatever.
Yeah, which, like galaxy just
looks,
look.
Yeah, it just looks good. The HomePod has a light.
Yeah,
it's not a screen.
It has a 20 pixel screen that's covered by like a cloudy filter, just, you know, like diffusion filter.
Yeah.
So apparently they're moving to that method. I don't really know why they're doing that because like I think the audio tone thing's cooler. Like it's cooler just to be in the room and you hear it go. And then it found
and it had a fail backup, which is to enter a code that was, I think, spoken.
Like, yeah, it would like talk to you and tell you what to type in. So I don't know why they're going to this visual method instead. Probably, don't know. They're just like...
My only guess is that there was a fail rate with the old system that they thought was not okay. And so this has a higher success rate. But I've not had a bad experience with the old method. So and there was the backup version. So I don't know why either. But maybe beta.
Yeah, I think I'd prefer it if the audio tone version stayed. But whatever, you only have to do it once.
Yeah, and then
then also in iOS 13 Home app now, in beta 2, they show all these dialogues, which basically tease the features that you're getting in September for the HomePod.
Yeah, here's what you get. You get five splash screens before you can use the Home app. You get HomePod can now recognize multiple voices. That sounds promising. Maybe we can use it today. No. Siri can now recognize your voice in this home and allow you to use any HomePod in this home to play your music, ask Siri questions, or access personal information when your devices are nearby. Continue. Then you get personal requests, use Siri on the HomePod to read instant messages, make calls, check your calendar, and more when your phone is nearby. Use on every HomePod or customize. And then choose the devices where you want to use personal requests, which HomePods you can toggle each one, and then continue. And then they say, add your profile to Apple TV. By selecting your profile on Apple TV, you or anyone else can access your movies, TV shows, and music on Apple TV in this home. So not HomePod related, but they're promoting the tvOS feature in the Home app because TVs can appear, Apple TVs and HomeKit TVs can appear in the Home app. And then finally, they let us down and they say, HomePod update available this fall. You'll be able to use new features available to HomePod in iOS 13 when the software update is released this fall. No beta. We're just telling you this now.
The like copy kind of implies the good version of a multi-user HomePod experience, because you know, they kind of skipped over it on stage. They just said it would work with this, this, and this. But the copy literally says it can customize to your music tastes. You can ask it questions and you can access personal information. So it does seem like each member of your home is going to be able to add their own personal request device.
Based on family sharing, which is what, up to five people?
Six.
Six people?
Okay. Yeah.
So you and five other people can have HomePod profiles. If you have more people in your home than that, you're out of luck. But that's a starter at least.
Oh. Yeah. And the customization where you can, even if you're not using the different profiles, you can just say, use personal requests on this HomePod and not the others is pretty nice. Like, just to simplify the setup for that. Because then I think it's pretty common if you had two HomePods that one might be in a personal room and then one might just be in like the kitchen or the lounge and you just don't want to do any personal requests on the one in the lounge or whatever. So it's nice that they're like streamlining the experience. It would obviously be most ideal if they would have like a HomePod beta program so we could like try the stuff out, but yes, it's not going to happen this year.
Yeah. And then what's wireless audio sync for Apple TV from iOS devices?
Yeah, so this is, I think they teased it on like that big like word cloud slide at WWDC, but obviously nothing, you know, no exposition. So new in these betas, if you have a iOS 13 device and you have a tvOS 13 device, you can go into the settings on the Apple TV and in like the place where you choose your audio and video settings, like the frame rate and the format and stuff, there'll be an option to synchronize the audio. And when you press the button on the Apple TV, it will find nearby compatible iOS devices and pop a little notification saying, start the wireless audio sync process. And then you click on that, and basically what happens is the iPhone listens to the TV. The Apple TV shoots out some noises at a set interval. The iPhone hears it, and it works out the delay. And then it can tell the TV what the delay was and synchronize the audio. And the reason this is interesting is if you're in an environment where you have a TV and a soundbar or a speaker system that's wireless, then a lot of the time, due to like lag in the cable or lag in going over the air, you can get a slight delay on the between the audio and the video, because obviously the video goes straight over HDMI, but if you're streaming the audio to wireless speakers, then that like, you know, third of a second lag might be really annoying. And obviously looks like if you look at someone's lips, you can see the words come out of their lips before you hear them. And there wasn't really a great way to fix this before with the Apple TV. But now what they can do is have your iPhone listen, work out what that delay is, and then the Apple TV will offset the video frames, essentially reversing the delay, so sending the audio slightly faster if there was a delay that way or vice versa, which should mean that the audio and the video can be synchronized up. So this only affects you if you have like certain audio setups. If you're plugged in with a wire, then you're probably going to have, you know, zero lag. Realistically, everything has lag, but, you know, zero perceptible lag. But if you have, like, you know, wireless Bluetooth speakers, it could be more problematic, and this actually offers a fix for you.
Really cool.
Yeah, and there was, like, some Bluetooth speakers offer this option where you can say, like, delay it by 0.3 or 0.2 or whatever, but now if the iPhone can do it automatically, it's, you know, so much simpler.
Yeah, it's kind of a guess otherwise, unless it's, you know, some testing method. It would be kind of cool if they showed you like some sort of results from it. Like, I guess the ultimate test is it matched now or not? But from what I can see, it looks like it's just like done. It's done now. And Sonos has done a thing where they do like true play tuning, and they'll tell you, we found enough changes that you'll hear a big difference, or we couldn't change anything in this room and don't expect to hear anything different. So I think something like that would be kind of cool. But I guess ultimate test is this sounds like it's synced now. So that's nice. There's also now picture in picture, which is like a super secret surprise for tvOS 13 beta 2.
Yeah, this is awesome. Like, why didn't they mention this on the stage? They had, you know, multi-user, they had the redesigned home screen, but then they didn't mention picture in picture. But at least in this beta, it's available, but it's only in the TV app, right?
Yeah, I think Tim just forgot. Yeah, it's in the TV app at least, and so that gives you iTunes movies and TV shows, plus there's a bunch of stuff that's actually streamed from in the TV app now if you use the channels feature. So if you subscribe to HBO or Showtime or any of those channels in the Apple TV app from any device using the channels feature where you pay Apple for those subscriptions, not download another app to do it, then they'll pip their own video. They're not doing picture in picture anywhere else yet, which it's different from like iOS and then the Mac, where there's the ability to put picture in picture from any source. Maybe it'll change in the future, but not yet, at least. And the way it works is, from what I've seen so far, is that you bring up like the play bar for like what's, you know, where you are in the video. And then there's a little button above that that shows, you know, the icon for picture in picture, like shrinking your video, and you select that. And then you get the pip in the TV app, and you can select the pip for more options, like go back full screen or go to the home screen, I think. And there's even like, there's no like click and drag or like touch and flick like there is on iOS and the Mac. So they have a new icon, which looks a lot like the old, expose icon, or spaces icon from like Snow Leopard version of macOS, but it's like four boxes in a rectangle as a grid. And what that is you can click it and then it takes you to one corner, and then the icon changes and you click it and it goes to another corner.
Oh, so you like cycle through basically.
Yeah, you cycle through. And then you can take it to the home screen. Once you know, if it's playing in the TV app, you can pip in the TV app and continue browsing, or you can pip back to the home screen and then find, like, you know, go to another app. I haven't tested, like, if it continues in another app. That would be ideal, though, if you can, like, watch your video from the TV app and then, like, use – I think that would be useful in, like, not just browsing for more video to watch, but, like, another TV app that's not for video. Like, those exist, so that would be cool.
Yeah, I don't think – you won't be able to watch two videos at once because – the iPad and the iPhone don't do that either. Like, mm-hmm. You can just play the pip on one video stream, and if you start playing another one, the pip pauses or whatever. But you can definitely, like, run the video in the corner of the screen and then browse around in the TV app or in another app to, like, find something else you want to watch. And that is a feature that I've really missed on... I love the Apple TV, but compared to, like, my cable box, when I'm on the cable box and I watch something and then I look for something else and I go to, like, the program guide, well, in the... you know, the top right-hand corner of the screen is a little thumbnail of the current channel that's been playing. And you don't, mm-hmm. you know, you don't go to silence and you don't get jumped out and stop what you're listening to. It just carries on playing in the corner until you find something else, and then it switches back to full screen with the new content. And
yeah, very modern.
Yeah. And that's just something that the Apple TV has not been able to do, and it has the horsepower to do it. And so it's great that it's coming, and you can just, you know, play something in Apple TV Plus, you know, this fall. Oh, you're halfway through the show, you don't want to watch this anymore. Pip it out and start browsing the rest of the catalog and find something else to watch. Like, it's just like a modern TV experience, and I'm, you know, very happy that it's included and it's available on both the 2015 Apple TV and the 4K version as well. So everyone can use it.
I really like it. Yep. I also want to give an update on AirPlay 2 and the Apple TV app on Samsung TV. So it was like last month. I think it was like around May 13th, when Samsung, it was the same day that iOS 12.3 came out. Samsung said, our TVs will now get a firmware update. This long list of 2019 and 2018 TVs that supports AirPlay 2 out of the box and the new Apple TV app. And then this fall, Apple says Vizio and Sony and LG will also get those features, plus HomeKit support. And they don't get the TV app, right? They, at least not yet that we know of. Like,
they said it's coming later.
Okay, coming later. So so there are plenty of Samsung TVs that now work with this. There's a long list on Apple's website of HomeKit accessories that of Samsung TVs that are supported. And then they all say, like, they just say that they're supported now. I bought one of those TVs because it was $299, which was like, you know, fair price for like just testing the feature out and writing about it and talking about it on the podcast. But it hasn't gotten the firmware update yet. We mentioned in the show like that seems like the more expensive TVs have gotten the firmware update first. So my strategy has been to, I found where the firmware like is listed on Samsung's website. And so I've got a pinned tab in Safari, so it's always up there, and I can just click it every now and then and see, is this changed yet? And I had like a change detector on the page in case it changed, I'd get an alert for it too. But yesterday on June 18th, it changed. There was new firmware. And I raced to my TV. I went to the settings. I went to update now, and it still can't see the update. I've tried for 2 days now and it canceled the update yet. So that's a thing. The other thing you can do is download the firmware update to a USB drive and then stick it on the TV and then go to the same update route and it will find it as long as the firmware update is in a folder and it's the, like, not in another folder. So it's visible by the TV. That hasn't worked for me. And the only thing I can guess is, like, maybe my drive formatted the wrong way and I could just, like, put it in like FAT32 mode or something and maybe that'll work. But I literally got to the point where, like, when I was about to update the TV, I thought, I couldn't remember, does this work with AirPlay? Is this for, like, I know it's for the TV app. Is it for AirPlay 2 as well? I had to, like, go and look at my own story to find out.
It's just been so long.
It's been that long. But the next thing I'm going to do is try and format my USB drive and then try again if the OTA doesn't work. And I even got a little bit, like, just worried that maybe I goofed something and, like, got some wrong model number and I don't have a TV that will work. Because I have made that mistake before. Like, I bought a 1080p TV that was the same price as a 4K TV and didn't realize it for, like, 6 months. I had a colleague look at the story, the accessory list from Apple, the firmware page I'm referencing, and then, like, a picture of my TV model number. And he's like, yes, that's all correct. So I don't feel crazy about that. But then I was looking at the release notes for the firmware update, and it just says, like, stability improvements. Like, it doesn't say Apple TV app and AirPlay 2. So then I'm like, am I fretting over, like, a firmware update that isn't even going to do what I wanted to do? So I searched Samsung's support library and found where someone was complaining about their TV borking out after the update, which might explain why I haven't got it yet. And that the only thing it added was a stupid new TV app. And I was like, relief. It's definitely going to be in this firmware update. It was the same number and everything. Sorry about that guy's TV. Maybe that's why I don't have the update yet, because it's actually bad for your TV and they've got to, like, work on it. But at least that's the version with the TV app. So maybe next week I'll have some resolution here. I'm looking. I really, at this point, it's like a novelty all over again to be able to use the TV app on a Samsung TV without an Apple TV and to have AirPlay 2, which is really cool. So tune in next week and we'll see.
It's easy to think that cybercrime is something mysterious that happens to other people. It's easy to feel like nobody wants your data. But you'd be mistaken. Stealing data from public Wi-Fi is one of the simplest and cheapest ways for nefarious hackers to make money. When the internet connection is unencrypted, your data is being transferred over the air in the open. You can't see it with your eyes, but unencrypted network traffic can be easily read by unscrupulous actors as if it was written on a poster on the wall. Take back your privacy with ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address so no one can see what you're doing. To enable ExpressVPN, it just takes one click. It has easy-to-use apps that run seamlessly in the background on your computer, phone, and tablet. You can get up and running for less than $7 a month. One subscription applies to every device you own, from Macs to iPhones to iPads, even Android phones, home routers, and other devices too. ExpressVPN is the number one VPN service as rated by TechRadar and comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Use ExpressVPN to surf public Wi-Fi without fear of being snooped on and keep your personal data private. ExpressVPN also creates an internet without borders, defeating content restrictions for online media, music services, and more by masking your real IP address wherever you are in the world. ExpressVPN has 24/7 human support to help you get up and running and troubleshoot any issues. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/happyhour. That's expressvpn.com/happyhour for 3 months free with a 1 year package. Thanks to ExpressVPN for sponsoring the show.
All right, Mayo. Also this weekend, I think it was actually today, there's a new story about the state of the you know, quote unquote Marzipan apps, now called Catalyst apps, that were introduced with macOS Mojave, and they might get upgraded sometime in the macOS Catalina beta period. What's the story and what's your take on it?
Right. So CNET had an interview with Federighi where they were talking about the four apps that are already, that have been on the Mac for a year. That's News, Voice Memos, Home, and Stocks. And his comments kind of mirror what he said in an interview with Federighi Vittici in, like, his, like, post WWDC podcast. Basically, responding to, you know, the criticism the widespread criticism of those apps being really bad, Federighi said that people were blaming the technology stack, i.e. Catalyst, when the problems in the app were really just out of design decisions about how Apple had made them. So it wasn't like a limitation of the framework. It was Apple just had them this way and the Mac users didn't like them because they designed them like iOS apps. Mm-hmm. That's what Federighi says. So he basically blames Apple for not being good at designing Mac apps anymore, in short. Now, that's okay to say, but in the current situation, there are effectively no changes to any of those four apps in Catalina. And it's running Catalyst now. And if Federighi had heard the criticism last year and agreed with it, because he's saying, you know, they made the wrong choices, then sure, you would expect the four apps to be better in Catalina. But to date, they're not the same. What this CNET article says is that part of the upgrade, we're going to evolve around the aesthetics of the Mac experience, and so we made some adjustments to the apps. That's the Federighi quote. If you look in the current seeds, there are no changes apart from, like, some of the apps have more keyboard shortcuts, which just seems to be like, oh, the iPad apps have keyboard shortcuts now, so they're on the Mac too. The design of the apps are still, you know, they're basically identical to the Mojave apps. The home thing still has the scrolling picker. It doesn't have like a Mac form editor. It doesn't have, they don't take advantage of the like multiple window support now available in the SDK, which obviously would benefit the iPad as well. All of the stuff is still very single window. The home app stuff opens in single window things that you have to like dismiss as weird modals. It's all the same rubbish that we had last year. Now, here's the quote. Federighi says, "Wait for the public beta. We're still tuning everything up. That's where it gets really good." So that one line, the CNET article extrapolates out as the four apps are going to get really good by the time the public beta comes out. And Apple has said the public beta is coming out in July. So it's probably going to be the next beta, like beta 3.
Two weeks out, right?
Yeah, 2 weeks' time. Or beta 4 if they go to the very end of July.
Yeah.
I'm a bit skeptical. Like, the Federighi quote does not say these four apps are getting better in the public beta. It just says, wait for the public beta. We're still tuning everything up. And tuning everything up, you know, redesigning the apps is arguably more work than a tune-up. Like, the apps need a lot of time invested in them to get better. And normally, this isn't how Apple rolls, right? They have this stuff in the betas already. The home app does have design changes, because it has design changes in iOS. But in terms of Mac-specific adjustments, there's nothing in 1 or 2. So we are clinging on to Federighi's words that we are waiting for the public beta. We're still tuning everything up. What do you think about that?
I mean, at this point, I'm going to be optimistic that by calling out design and Mac-like, that's what he's talking about. Because he says, like, automatically by using Catalyst and Catalina, you're no longer running two processes, one for AppKit, one for UIKit. It's now a single process, so you're automatically going to have improvements there. The idea of, if you don't see improvements yet, wait for the public beta. That's when they're tuning things out. I think maybe that means that they just have bigger plans for the third seed, that it will have more changes than the first two have had. I'm optimistic that that's what that means, and that we will see a new design for some of these apps. Like, there'll be small tweaks, but they'll be there. But I don't know. I can't parse it exactly. I mean, the counterpoint to what I'm saying is that, you know, we had the discussion about the Federighi email to a customer, someone, about 3D touch returning that was a bug. And from what we've seen so far in beta 2 of iOS 13, you still can't do the thing where you press into an app icon, swipe up, and release your finger off of one of the actions, and then do that action without, you still got to press in, let go,
tap again.
And do it quick enough that you don't enter the jiggle mode, even on 3D touch phones. So,
and that email was in the time period of beta 1, and he was the guy was asking about 3D touch not being there, and Federighi said, that's a bug, wait for the next beta. So that was, and obviously DevSeed 2's come out, and there are essentially zero changes to 3D touch in this seed, apart from, like, the sound's different if you have sounds on, but when you press down, it has a little sound effect.
Yeah.
So you know, I'm not putting too much stead in Federighi's words here. Like, I feel like he plays a bit fast and loose. Like, we're still tuning things up. And especially because the C-note question, because, you know, when you're like a real journalist, quote unquote, you have to do this thing where when you write an article, you can't like embed the question that you ask the person in the article, because that's considered like, you know, amateurish and like bad form. So you have to like construct the narrative and then just include the quote. So it just says, wait for the public beta. We're still tuning everything up. That's where it gets really good. The bit before that is CNET saying, if you don't see the changes to the new voice memos stocks app in this current beta, don't start worrying yet. And then it like connects the quotes together like that, where it's not entirely clear to me that that's exactly what Federico was applying to. CNET could have asked, well, in the current beta, the apps still aren't very good. You know, or in the current beta, the apps are buggy, full stop. And so then if he replies, oh, we're still tuning everything up, then that kind of follows. Oh, you know, they're getting the bugs ready for the public release or the public beta release. So mm-hmm. I'm not like wedded to this as, oh, the app's going to get completely changed, because it seems unrealistic to me that they wouldn't have mentioned it on stage at all, or even in any of the sessions. You know, like when they were doing the Project Catalyst sessions for developers, mm-hmm. often if they have used technologies themselves, they will show the examples. For instance, this year, there was changes to the collection view component, and actually the App Store app on iOS uses the new API as a kind of like endorsement. Like, we're using this ourselves, so you can use it too, you know, according to the developers. Well, it'd be perfect for a Project Catalyst session to be like, here's our apps from last year, here's what we've done to make them more Mac-like, you know, and they'll be coming out in a later seed. We didn't get any of that. We just like attached this notion now that, oh, they're going to be really good in 2 weeks' time, and you know, I just don't see it. Generally, Apple's betas don't work like that. The features come out in like the first seed or the second seed, and then it's like bug fixes through the end and like maybe some minor tweaks. They're not going to have like the whole... It just seems impossible to me that the home app's suddenly going to be spawning like multiple windows left, right, and center in 2 weeks' time.
Or sidebar or something. It's a good mystery, so we'll find out in a couple of weeks. I'm more optimistic than you are, but we should have a conclusion.
Maybe if you hadn't already burned me on the 3D Touch thing, because I still hate the 3D Touch being removed. Like, sort it out, please.
Me too.
If that hadn't have happened, maybe I'd been more upbeat, but now I'm like, you know, in checking out every single like phrasing of it, and it's like, there's definitely a lot of wiggle room in his reply and even like the question that CNET would have asked in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Also this week, so moving on from the betas, all the beta news, this is sort of a beta update. the sleep tracker company that Apple bought a few years ago, Bedit, that's the strip that goes under your mattress, and then you use an iPhone app to see data measured from that about your sleep quality and duration and everything. Apple, like, since they bought Bedit, they replaced the hardware, the version 3 hardware with version 3.5 hardware that kind of removes some features, but then it like improves some other features. So it's kind of a mixed bag there. What they're doing now is they've opened up a beta program where if you're a Bedit 3.5 model customer, so the latest model, you can apply to be in the beta program. And then test features before they come out and give feedback on them. Like, part of the expectation is that you tell Bedit what you're thinking, or Apple in this case. And you've got to be in the US. You've got to be age 22 to 75. But it's kind of weird because you would think that Apple buys Bedit and they integrate like whatever their, you know, intelligence about sleeping is into the Apple Watch or something, and not just keep relying on this $150 strip that goes under your mattress, which doesn't even like scale to sleeping elsewhere. So it's really weird. And there are like really good sleep tracking apps on the Apple Watch. Like, I use Sleep Plus Plus, or no, I use Auto Sleep, but Sleep Plus Plus was another option. There's also Sleep Watch, Sleep Cycle, and Pillow. But the only thing Apple does is they have their clock app on the iPhone with bedtime mode, and it will try to track your sleep based on like your iPhone usage but that's not detailed at all. So when you use like heart rate data and everything, you get way more information, and the accelerometer. So it's really weird. And there's there's the Bloomberg report that says that Apple's still testing sleep tracking natively on the Apple Watch. At Apple Park.
Yeah, and German kind of implied that the timeline for that was the next year's watch.
Yeah, like at the soonest next year's watch. So maybe not next year's watch, but that, like, the rumors for the Series 5 are super light right now. Like, the only rumor is that
ceramic
will return. Because the white ceramic and the gray ceramic were in the Series 3, white ceramic on the Series 2, and then nothing for the Series 4. So the rumor is that ceramic returns to the Series 5 with a new all-screen design. But that's the only feature that we know. Like, the other part of that rumor was from Ming-Chi Kuo, was that the ECG feature goes to more countries. That's already happened. So that's no longer a rumor. Other than that, we don't know what to expect from the Series 5. German says Series 6 at the soonest for sleep tracking. And that always, like, as the further out his reports are from, like, things happening, they can, you know, shift if they're not ready yet.
Yeah. So. And in Mark's pre-WWDC, like, roundup, he actually mentioned a load of, like, sleep mode features for iOS 13. And those are not in the releases. Like, they didn't announce them or anything.
Well, they're still tuning things up.
So. Yeah, they'll be in the public beta.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that kind of implies that it kind of got yanked out and they were just like working on it. So, like, Apple relying on people buying this additional accessory that like you have to tie down to your actual bed is clearly not the long term plan. It just can't be, right?
It can't be, right?
Yeah. They have, you know, very good third party apps can get very good sleep tracking data based on the watch. And Apple wants to sell watches. They don't really want to sell these random bed strips that don't really work with multiple people either, and it's really complicated, and, you know, people don't want to strap that stuff down to their bed. They just don't. It's so much easier to just wear your watch to sleep. But
the way I'm looking at this story is that it's got to be their way of, like, opening, going from, like, employee testing to public customer testing. But they can't do it with the watch yet. Like, they don't do that with features. You know, they do in, like, the developer public beta. Well, there's no public beta for the watch. But they do that with, like, developer betas where you can send feedback for, you know, a few months before they release it. Surely they can learn things from the beta program that can apply to their native sleep tracking solution next fall. But that's my optimistic take on this story, is that they're looking to widen their testing, but they can't do it with unreleased hardware or software.
Yeah, and people who, and, you know, like, the hardcore Bedit fan base was really annoyed, actually, with the Bedit 3.5, because it took out a lot of features that was in the previous versions. Mm-hmm. As well, so
including, I think, Android support. no big deal.
Yeah, but even stuff like basic graph analysis, I think someone said on the original 3.5 app you couldn't even, like, zoom into the graph. Like, it's really weird how they're managing that kind of subsidiary at the moment, and mm-hmm. when it seems like all their focus should just be on getting sleep tracking on the watch to be good and getting out as soon as possible, even with the, you know, current issues with battery life, when do you charge it, whatever, you know, people have decent workarounds today, and that's why apps like Always Sleep and SleepPass are really, really popular. You know, and Apple's basically endorsing them now by not releasing their own of any kind. But it seems like a wrong strategic choice to limit sleep tracking to hardware that's not coming out for another year and a bit. Because I guarantee that must be when people are weighing up, like, do you want to buy a Fitbit? Do you want to buy an Apple Watch? You know, like, what smart fitness device do you want? The fact that the Apple Watch, quote unquote, doesn't have sleep tracking is in, like, a massive turn off of people. And the whole, like, you know, like, subline, oh, it's, you can get a third party app that does it, like, that doesn't count. When you're just buying the thing in the shop, it will have sleep tracking and the bullet point will not be ticked, but it will be for the Fitbit. So it seems a really bad choice that they're not going to do it, you know, maybe at least for one whole, you know, hardware generation, not even next year's software. It's like, oh, you have to buy a brand new watch just to do this, and it might not even come out till, you know, late 2020. It just seems not the greatest choice. And instead, they're, like, doing this beta program with this Bedit thing. They need, I don't know, I feel like they're making the wrong moves here.
Yeah, and then they bought Bedit, it was May 2017, so it's, like, 2 years ago. And that's, like, you could see that meaning, like, watchOS 6 would have had sleep tracking as a feature, or, like, this, it would be surprising, you know, based on Garmin's report, if the Series 5 had sleep tracking. Like, I think everyone would be kind of surprised by that, because Mark Garmin has really good sources, so it doesn't seem likely. but like, surely Bedit was just an acqui-hire of, like, the talent and then learning, like, you know, using what they know about sleep tracking, and not because they think that the future of sleep tracking is this iPhone accessory that's so limited compared to something built in. So, yeah, we'll see how that one goes. Tell me about Ming-Chi Kuo, and, you know, speaking of 2020 products, his new report on the iPhone lineup, not this fall, but next year, next fall.
Yeah, I don't know why everyone like knee-jerk laughs when we hear next year's iPhone rumors before this one's come out. Like, this happens all the time.
It's because 2020 sounds like it's so far away, you know, because you're changing the number.
Yeah.
From, especially like 2020, yeah.
Yeah, you get like these, you know, weird supply chain sources on stuff that's a bit further out. But Quo has a really good record of being incredibly accurate, even, you know, skipping generations. Like, he did the iPhone 10 breakdown basically the same time that the previous one came out. Obviously, we had the whole thing with the headphone jack situation, which was like the November. It's definitely happened before. Like, the iPhone 10, from my recollection, was the rumors about the iPhone 10 going full display were the year before. So in the iPhone 7 Plus year, there were already pretty solid rumors about the iPhone 10, like full screen design, that kind of thing. So this is not like a new phenomenon. It is interesting what he says, though, because first off, 5G. Yeah, this is the expectation, right? We've already heard this. The 5G is not happening this year for Apple. It's going to be next year. He says, by the way, that this year's 2019 phones will continue to use Intel chips. So even though Intel's getting out of the business, they are apparently committed for supplying this year's baseband chips anyway. And then from 2020, Apple moved to Qualcomm chips. But the 5G thing's like, you know, whatever. We've heard this like a million times over. The interesting thing for me is that he also mentions screen sizes and specifications. Quo says for the 2020 lineup, there will be three new iPhones. All three will have OLED displays, but they'll actually be tweaking the screen rate, the screen sizes for at least two of the models. So he calls the high-end models the 5.4-inch and the 6.7-inch. So that would be the equivalent of the XS and the XS Max today. But obviously the XS is 5.8 inches and the XS Max is 6.5. So you're going smaller and bigger at both ends of the spectrum. And those two models would get 5G next year, which is what makes them, you know, high-end in his report. Meanwhile, you have the 6.1 inch phone, which is OLED. So that would be a different screen technology to the iPhone XR, but the same screen size. And that one would not get 5G. So that's why it'd be the lower tier model. And that's why we're considering that one to be the iPhone XR replacement. But not even the iPhone XR replacement, the iPhone XR 2 replacement, because, you know, we're skipping out the generation in the middle that's coming out this fall with.
Yeah, yeah. This year, we believe the same screen sizes as the current iPhones and the same screen technologies with OLED at the pricier end, which is the smallest and biggest phone, and then LCD and at the bottom of the price, which is the middle screen size.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like this. You know, this idea, because I think there are people who want like the nicest iPhone, but not the biggest iPhone. And they'll consider the, you know, the XS size too big, even, you know, like it's a compromise that you've got to deal with. But that there is room to go down, without feeling like it's a tiny phone, like it's a toy. And then at the same time, like when I was using the Max size, the XS Max phone, you know, one complaint was, this is not optimized for the screen size in terms of the software. There's things that Apple could do here that they're not doing, and that's not resolved with iOS 13 either. But maybe if they make it, and I also felt like it's so big that it's in a range that could be even bigger, and it wouldn't affect my usability. Like, you know, it's too big for me to use one-handed anyway without using like reachability, which is okay. And there's this new swiping keyboard, which is really cool, but that it could be even bigger, and then it might warrant special features that are only on that size. And it's kind of funny because, like, you know, people saw the Max name, and they, you know, kind of assumption was like that implies it's as big as an iPhone can go. It's not plus, it's Max. It's at capacity. But then two generations later, then there's going to be a bigger version.
Yeah, and Max physically, the 6.7 inch might not be that different from the Max today, right? If you made the bezel's even thinner because, you know, it's bezel-less, but really there's still borders there. So you could probably squeeze, you know, 1 inch if you literally just went edge to edge properly, and then you'd get, not 1 inch, 0.1 inch. And then the other 0.1 inch would make the phone slightly bigger in the hand. So the 6.7 is close enough to the 6.5 that, you know, chassis changes, design changes, thinner bezels probably could make up most of that difference, because the 2020 phones we are expecting to have like chassis design changes, unlike this year, which is like another, you know, tick S generation. But the 5.4 inch model, like 0.4 inches different to the XS is significant. Like, you couldn't... That would be definitely physically smaller by a noticeable margin. It would probably take the diagonal down to about... If you took below where the notch is now, where the notch protrudes down, if you went down basically to where the lock icon comes for Face ID and you just drew a line there, that's kind of where the phone would stop. So it's, you know, significantly smaller. And there has been a lot of outcry for people who, you know, mourn over the iPhone SE and that screen size and stuff, that we want high-end features, but we don't want the biggest screens. So this could be the answer to those people. It's not as small as the iPhone SE by any means, but, you know, definitely be more, like, pocketable and hold and easier to hold in the hand than the current lineup.
Yeah, so the 4-inch screen size is still in the lineup with iOS 13. You get the iPod Touch, the new generation, you get the iPhone SE, and then you get the scaled versions on the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus and those size phones. So I tried this week on one of the new iPods my family has. I put iOS 13 on it because it doesn't really matter. And I looked at the share sheet, and, you know, you remember last week you were talking about how your complaint is that you can only see, like, one of the actions below the icon rows and in the friends suggestions rows. I was wondering, like, how many can you see on the iPod Touch, or how high does it go on the screen? And it goes almost to the top of the screen, and you can't see any of the actions below. You've got to scroll to see any actions. So it's not optimized for an SE. Like, and if there was an SE2 in the same form factor, it was just a new processor, I think people would be very disappointed in how new software runs on that. And so I agree. I think leaning in on making a phone that costs more than the middle size screen, because it has 5G, you know, maybe something with the camera, then that's, you know, that's pretty cool. Like, you can people that want a bigger screen, you've got the Max Plus or whatever they want to call it, and you've got, you know, if you want to make it up in volume, you've got the middle, the 10R replacement, 10R2 replacement. So I like this rumor. And if you're going to make the 10R replacement nicer, like, you remove the screen type as something that makes it different, which I think would please a lot of people that know about the stuff. Then you need to have even more gap between the top and the model, you know, the smaller and bigger than that. And by playing with the size, then you do that. You lean into the benefits of a smaller phone and a bigger phone. You make it even bigger and even smaller. So I like this rumor.
Yeah, thinking selfishly, I really like the current, like, iPhone XS size. So, and going down, I probably wouldn't choose to go down by 0.4. But for the 2020 year, assuming, like, 5G was the major differentiator between, you know, the 10R and the high-end one, I'd probably opt for the 6.1-inch OLED, because that's still, you know, basically the same size as the 5.8. It'd have the nice screen, and I expect where I live in the UK, we probably won't have good 5G coverage for a long time. Like, I think 5G is going to take a while to become, you know, like, ubiquitous, and ultimately, I'm not, like, super sold on the 5G hype train at the moment. Like, yes, it'll be nice for stuff to be faster, but everything has data caps, so you're limited in what you can download. And when I'm out and about today, stuff's generally fast enough. And I know you always say this before it happens. It's like, this feels fast enough, and something fast comes along. You're like, how did I live with that thing before? But especially as we're still in the, you know, the data cap generation, at least in Britain, it's hard to find, you know, like, bigger than, like, 10 gigabyte plans, and they're, like, the expensive ones. So am I that, like, interested in the 5G side of life? Not, you know, necessarily right now, especially where I live, which is not, you know, like, center of London. I mean, I still struggle to get 4G in places where around me. So the 5G deployment is definitely going to be further out. So at least for the 2020 year, you know, maybe I'd move to the 6.1-inch phone. Obviously, we don't know yet about the specifications, whether there'd be other differentiation that would, you know, tip the balance. But if you're going to put an OLED screen on 6.1-inch, that'd be, you know, really nice. So, yeah, I think this could accommodate everyone, you know, pretty happily.
Yeah, I agree. And I think for me, like I do think it's too bad that 5G won't be on this fall's iPhones when there are Android phones that have 5G already. And there are, like, big markets in the US, like, not big in terms of, like, big on the map, but, like, big in terms of population, that are doing 5G this year. Like today, they're live. You can test them if you have an Android phone with 5G support. And the fact that people buy $1,000 phones, and they expect to use them for more than you know, 1 year. Even with the perks of like a trade-in program or something, I think it's reasonable to say you want the, you know, your $1,000 phone to be pretty good for the next 5 years or so. Like three to five years is probably a pretty long time, but like maybe say 3 years. And if 5G comes, like if 5G were in this fall's iPhones and there wasn't the whole Qualcomm lawsuit and then settlement, then you could buy the 5G iPhone this year, and then within the lifespan of that phone, before the new one even comes out, you could probably be online in 5G in the US at least, and in other markets around the world, like big major cities around the world and other countries are doing 5G already. So, but I agree with you that I think like we'll have to just wait and see what the impacts of 5G are. It, you know, I think the promise is just like higher download speeds that are more closer to like a good Wi-Fi connection. But then like latency and upload.
And data caps.
And don't look good. Yeah, I've got an unlimited data plan now that it's for the family. So it's nice that there's no like, wait, you know, is my mom using too much data? Do I have to talk to her about her data usage, you know, and ask her to use Wi-Fi more? Like it's nice for that reason. There is a data cap on using hotspot so that you can't like share your internet with like, you know, your television streaming all night or something. But, at least for the data itself, I'm not sure that there's like I think if the network's crowded, then you can slow down, but I don't think it's too much based on what you use. I'm not sure that, well, I think it's like 25 gigabytes actually, then you slow down, but, which is not unlimited, but.
So on your 5G version, you can use your 25 gigs in like 5 minutes and then you can be back on 4G speed.
Yeah. I don't have an issue with connectivity in terms of like finding 4G, which is nice. Like there's LTE almost everywhere that I, you know, around where I live. On AT&T at least. And I even found, you know, the quote unquote 5GE yesterday, about an hour away from me in Mobile, Alabama. And I just noticed I'm on 5GE now. I did a speed test and it was still the same speed as before, but shocker. With 5 bars, but you know, yeah.
And at least based on Apple's like rumors, it seems like Apple's going to do an iPad in the spring with 5G capability, followed by the iPhone in the fall. That was like the latest we've heard. Obviously, it's only been like single source at this point, so you know, don't rely on it. But that seems to be the roadmap, in that Apple's going to test the waters with the 5G iPads in like the spring, and not do one this fall, and then follow with the iPhones at the end of the year. Which I think mirrors. Didn't they do that before with the iPads, where they gave the iPad 4G like LTE first, and then did the iPhone later?
I think so. Yeah. So yeah, and you know, your logic on 5G is sound, that like, you know, what will it be practical for? Data caps are an issue, coverage is an issue. But I still think like people want their iPhone to be as good as Android phones.
Oh, sure. And like as a sticker selling point, it's still a downside.
Yeah. And you want your iPhone, like if 5G is like in places you might travel to, then you want to be able to experience that, you know, even if it's rare. So for some reason for me, like, even though I can't tell you why 5G matters, like definitively, you know, like you can do so much on LTE right now. I still put 5G as like pretty high on the, you know, the request for iPhone features in the future, to the point where like I would recommend a lot of people skip this year's iPhones and wait for next year's iPhones. Like people that I know that won't upgrade, like people who still use like iPhone 6, 6S, 7 today, like if they have that buying habit, you know, then I would say skip this year's iPhones, because next year you'll get 5G and you use your iPhone for a long time.
Sure.
So that will matter for you, you know, eventually. And people, you know, look at the, you know, the market of old iPhones, like you can still buy the iPhone 10 in some places. And so, or, you know, refurbished or you know, sold individually phones. So it delays, I guess, the uptick of 5G adoption from iPhones if by missing this year. But it's okay, it's just not ideal.
Yeah, I'm just kind of like waiting for, you know, like the, oh, I like the thing that I really want to do with the 5G, because as it stands, all I've seen all these tech reviewers do is just post like speed tests. It's like, this is really fast. It's like, yeah, but you know,
I saw Chris Welch with The Verge using things like download entire movies very quickly. And that's, you know, that goes back to your data cap point, you know, and you know,
how, but you can download a 1080p movie, or, you know, pretty damn quickly already. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I think the movie, again, that's where an iPad maybe makes more sense, because you could download like a 4K, you know, film on 5G to be faster.
If the stuff. Promise was like, you're not going to see a bad connection on FaceTime, like you can go anywhere on 5G and the connectivity is so much better that you're never going to see reconnecting or just hear the audio because the video won't load, or if you're on a group FaceTime call, the exclamation point. So that would be pretty promising, but just faster. Like, it's kind of like, I have gigabit internet at home, and my Wi-Fi download is going to be like up to 800 gigabits, and like on the wire it's much faster, it's like up to 1,000, but it's nice, but I don't, you know, like I don't do anything differently on my iPhone than I would that at home on Wi-Fi than I do out of the home on Wi-Fi. So I get your point.
Yeah, like I'm on 300 megs home broadband. Mm-hmm. And it's nice, but and if I went to 1,000, I'd get 1,000 if it was available, and, you know, not insanely expensive, which isn't. I don't think it's even available here. But I wouldn't expect like my computing usage to change dramatically. It'd just be stuff be slightly faster. But when I'm working, you know, I'm generally, you know, more often downloading bigger files. Like all these Xcode bays keep coming out, and they're like 10 gigs a try. So the home broadband speed is like important, and you share it with your family, and so it's nice to have, you know, high speed everywhere. But when you're on the go, I just don't feel like held back by the download speed at the current time. And I am pretty pessimistic about 5G deployment and rollout. Like, it's very like marketing buzzwordy. I don't think it'll be like pervasive for, you know, like 2-3 years still. Like, so maybe by late 2020 it'll be coming in just right, so it's covering like 50% of the US, for instance. But then I bet that remaining 50% will take like another 3 years. Like, it's going to be slow.
Moving on, this week we have a new Mark Gurman report on Apple Card availability. According to Mark Gurman, prior to this report, Apple employees were testing the credit card. Apple so far has promised that it would launch in the U.S. in the summertime, which begins on Friday, June 21st. Now he says that Apple Card testing has expanded to retail employees, presumably only in the U.S., but that spans thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. So the test group here has expanded much likely, or much further. Two things from this that I see: if they just expand today or, you know, recently, that implies that Apple Card and iOS 12.4 won't launch on like Friday, like that's what I was expected to, or like early next week. That's unlikely. That will probably means at the soonest late, like even later July or June.
Like mid-July probably is like the earliest.
Yeah. Yeah. At the soonest like late June, but like mid-July, or like if they're still doing testing, like, and I'm not sure what the testing is. Like, I guess it's use the card, try the features out. Do they work? Okay. Good.
It's not like the air power, Matt. The card's not like combusting.
Right. But I suppose with all the software involved in the wallet app, you know, from applying for the card, you don't want issues, and then all the payment options and alerts and everything. Like, there are some features here that need testing. So, and I wonder, I don't know if the report has details about this, but like, by testing, does that mean that they're literally applying for the credit card and then racking up their own balance? Or is it like there's some compensation involved here? Like, you've got play like real money from Apple to use because you purchase real items, or is it like a simulation entirely? I don't know. So I'm more curious, like, on the details of like what's the testing a credit card like.
Yeah, and if you got tens of thousands of people testing the card in real life, you would expect someone to notice.
Yeah, like this thing to get leaked more than it has so far. So.
Yeah, and it's pre-announced, obviously. So it's
Yeah. Like, it's going to be, maybe you can only use it in the Apple store. And so it's like free money for Apple in a way, or they just expense all the purchases that are made. But, and you got like a limit, like $50, or you can only buy like a headphone adapter or something. Like, I'm curious, like, if anyone knows, you know, email DMs are private and open, but, again, I think the big takeaway here is iOS 12.4 probably isn't coming out like this week or next week, that it's a little bit further off than that. Also in the Apple source space, Michael Stieber had a really interesting report on changes that are being tested at select Apple stores on how the shopping experience goes, how iPhones are presented, and then even how Apple Watches are presented. So what's new here that Stieber's reported?
Yeah, this is really cool, actually. Like, everyone complains, and it's kind of the meme that, you know, it's actually hard to buy stuff at the Apple store, and it feels like all these changes here address that, even if they weren't like setting out to, they do indirectly. So you have now a little stand where the three iPhones are in like this, they're on this single like black platter thing, and it has like the key features directly underneath. Rather than having to get like employees over to explain the differences between everything, you can just, you know, peer down at the three phones side by side and very quickly get the highlights of what's different between each of the models, which I think genuine problem that people face with, you know, the three phones looking very similar. I think people get confused, like, why is the iPhone XR $250 cheaper? And I think
it's bigger. Why is it cheaper?
Yeah, exactly. It's bigger. Why is it cheaper? Why does it have the longest battery life of any iPhone, even if it's cheaper? Like, there is some, you know, complexity and confusion there. And, you know, when you're buying a phone, you don't want to buy the wrong one. And so I reckon a lot of Apple Store traffic was people like asking, you know, which iPhone should I buy? And so these kind of fixtures help answer that question. They also doing like express checkout sections now in certain stores where you can just go in and pay for accessories and get out the door like faster instead of having to, you know, idly wander around and try and catch the attention of someone and help you buy something. There's like a designated section now you can go and check out the accessories. They have obviously have done for a while. They've tried to like promote self-checkout where you can just take it off the wall, scan it with the app and leave. Mm-hmm. That I don't think has been very popular. And it just kind of like people feel like they're stealing even if they've already paid for it. And so I don't think people generally do that.
Like, it's like a pro user thing to do, like a pro customer thing to do, but not like the average customer that's buying something from the Apple Store.
Yeah, and I've even heard like infrequently, but a very occasional horror stories of where someone actually picked something off the shelf, they bought it, they started to walk out, and then like a security guard like pinned them to the wall or like took them to the back, like because they didn't see them using the app or whatever, and so they were like accused of theft, and it's embarrassing to be in the middle of the store being like accused of theft. You know, I'm doing the thing that you told me to do, right? Mm-hmm. And so people just generally shy away from doing that. And plus, there are many more, you know, customers that just walk in on a daily basis. They have no idea you can even do it, right? Like, who even downloads the Apple Store app? Like, we do, but general public, not so much. So having, you know, just a nice little section where you can have one person that just lets you buy, you know, an Apple Pencil or a case or whatever in one shot is really, you know, really convenient and addresses a problem that people, you know, often complain about. And then finally, which I think is probably the coolest change, is these new like watch layouts and watch band displays, where you have before you'd have watches kind of under glass, and now at least in the Apple Store at Apple Park, they've put them raised up on a platter that's not covered by glass, and you can actually pick them up and put them straight on. So it is like use, not touch, which has been the old Apple Store motto, but in more recent years, some of that stuff hasn't been possible, especially with the watches that are so small. And they almost have like a Build-A-Bear layout now where you can see like just the bare watch chassis next to a load of different bands. You can kind of chop and change and try them out really quickly. Like that stuff I think is really cool.
Yeah. This looks really cool. So I'm going to back up a little bit here. I think the display for the iPhones themselves, like it looks like a vinyl sticker that just like adhesively applies to the table. And it looks kind of cheap. On like Apple Store standards, like more like traditional retail.
Does it look better than the trade in your iPhone for $10 from only $449?
Yes, it does look better than that. And like years ago, they would use iPad 2s, mm-hmm. As smart signs that you could tap a button on, which would summon a specialist or put your iPad. So you buy the iPad in the queue. And then when a specialist was available, they would come to you if you stayed at that place. But oftentimes people would press the button by accident or press it and then walk away, not knowing that it was the location of where someone's going to look for you in. And they replaced that system. And it also showed like product information. So you could like tap through, and it was tricky because some people were coming in to learn about the iPad and, why is this iPad like stuck on this table and you can't use it? So those went away and they replaced it with a prices app on the device. And the idea is if you want to learn about the device, pick it up and use it. And then there's the price, the features, et cetera. But if you're just looking at these phones at like a glance, then you don't figure it out. And so this new adhesive sticker, again, it's piloting. So it's only on like one Apple Store or so, not everywhere yet. But it's a solution to the problem. It's just in Steve's photo. Like, he had all of these photos sourced from people. Like, he knew about all the changes, but he waited till he had pictures to run the story. And so he had to like find people and that could go to those stores and take the pictures. Which I think is really cool. Like putting work into this, without, you know, being able to travel the globe. And like, but in his picture, like one of the vinyl stickers is like peeling up a little bit.
Yeah.
So looks a little bit rough, but
it'd be nice if they were like acrylic blocks or something.
Mm-hmm. You do get some good information from those, though. I love the Apple display. So this is at Apple Park Visitor Center, as you mentioned. And I was skeptical when he described this to me before I saw the pictures, because it's like under the glass, kind of classy, and you don't have people like fingerprinting them up, and they all look really good because they're like, it's like a light overhead and it just looks really bright. And it's like, I look at the same watch that I have and it just looks nicer under that glass case to me. And I think it's just like the trick of like bright lighting and then, you know, under glass. But what he has pictures of, it's like they literally took the same tables with the rectangle cut out for a glass pane and they replaced it. Like the wood doesn't even match. They replaced it with an individual square for each watch and it just like lines up with like I don't know, like 10 by 10 squares or something like that. And so it looks really good. Like you said, you can finally pick up the watch and play with it, you know, without having to go on to the like the single try-on station. And I've seen like pretty common watch bands out on display and you can like touch them and feel them, but not with the single watch, like just like as a new tray with like a slot for the band, but also a slot for like six watches too. And so you can mix and match like what is black, silver, gold, space gray. How do those look in different combinations? And it's like, you know, these are really cool. I hope that they have a good experience with what they're piloting, because I think this would be really cool at every Apple store, especially the Express Checkout. Like that is still a frustration to me a lot of times. Like, someone will ask you for help. You'll say, I'm okay for now. And then when you get time to pay for something, like if it's serialized, you can't buy it on your own.
It's like, where's Wally find the right genius that can actually help you?
Yeah. So you got to find the person who isn't like helping the genius bar or like with a customer or managing traffic in some way. And you're probably going to get put in a queue. And like they're supposed to have like one person on each of the accessory walls, but oftentimes that doesn't happen or they get busy, they get pulled away for something. So it's, in practice, it's really tricky. They do express checkout lanes like every Christmas holiday, because that way you can either pick up really fast or you can like buy something in the store and check out really fast if you don't want the full store experience. But having a dedicated section for that year round, like they show the Magic Mouse, AirPods, an adapter, Apple Pencil, and an iPhone case, like ideas for like what they're showing you there. That's really cool. So you're not going to go there and like ask questions. You're going to go there and pay and leave. So I like that. And I think this is also really good reporting from Stieber, because this is not announced or anything. And he had the information and all he needed were pictures, and he sourced those all down from people. So great, great work for Stieber there.
Yeah, it's a good story.
Yep. And last thing on this, like there was some, you know, interpretation of this is like, you know, Deirdre O'Brien's taking over and, Angela Arendt has left and like they're quickly fixing some of the problems that people thought that, you know, that they were there. So, you just never know. Like, for one, it's not like a global rollout. If it was, and maybe that would be stronger, but, it's piloting at single stores in the country. So it is testing. But it's not like, old bosses out, new bosses in, big changes everywhere yet. So, you know,
yeah. Maybe because it is only isolated as single like testing areas, that you could make more of an argument that this is, you know, more recent development. Like, mm-hmm. if it was a coordinated plan that had been deployed around the world, then you'd probably say, you know, it's too soon for it to really be a Deirdre thing, and it was just in the works mm-hmm. before. But if it, like this Express Checkout, I think is a good example. Like Deirdre announced that they announced that she was taking over in like January, and Angela didn't actually leave till April. But obviously, you know, Deirdre wants to get off the ground running, so she probably, you know, spend that time thinking on what I'm going to do first. And something like Express Checkout, which they've essentially done at Christmas time and at holidays before, but doing it all year round, is quite a simple way of addressing an issue that people have had. Mm-hmm. And they can just do it in this one store, and they can check that the employees don't get overwhelmed, and it, you know, helps with customer, you know, walking flows and everything like that. And if it's good, then maybe it will roll out, next year around the world. So I do think something like that is actually in the time frame of, you know, ingestion, development, and, you know, like a trial rollout. It's June now, right? Like, it's 6 months. Like, so something like that, I think, really could be a Deirdre thing. But you can't say for sure. Like, maybe this was in development the whole time. Maybe it wasn't. But I don't think it's out of the question that it could have been, you know, with the new blood comes, you know, some at least trials of some stuff that we could change.
Yeah, that's fair. A few more things this week before we head off. There's a new Apple Watch activity challenge set for the International Day of Yoga, which is the first activity challenge of this type that will be on June 21st, which in the U.S. is the first day of summer. And the thing to do here is on June 21st, celebrate the International Day of Yoga by earning this award with a yoga workout of 15 minutes of more or more. Record your time with any app that adds yoga workouts to health. So I think it's cool that this is the first challenge like this. You know, again, you get the award, you get sticker packs to unlock. I think when people see this pop up on their watch, they'll learn that their watch can track yoga for the first time. Like they might not have known that WatchOS 5 added that, that it's an option. And because before WatchOS 5, you log in other workout and then call it yoga. But with WatchOS 5, they added a dedicated workout for yoga. And I think yoga is really popular. So, and I actually enjoy it myself too. So I like this challenge.
Yeah. And it's the first one in a while that hasn't just been like an annual repeat of one they've done before.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Which means you get a new badge. Cause I kind of got bored of the, oh, it's the, you know, X challenge, but the 2019 version and the badge is like identical, except the year's different. So now it's a whole new challenge. So you get a whole new design badge, which is cool.
Yeah. I have had people ask me since this story broke, what yoga app do you have any recommendations for this challenge? Because I've never done yoga in my life and I want to do this challenge of a 15-minute yoga session to unlock the achievement. The one that I use is called Yoga Studio and it works on the iPhone, the iPad, and the Apple TV. When I first got the app, it was a paid upfront app. And so I paid one amount of money for it. And then I just have the app now. And I think you could probably add stuff for more money, but I've got like a lot of content for the price that I've paid like years ago. Now it's a free app with a free trial, but after I think a week, then you start subscribing to it or paying to unlock content. But if you only want like an app for the sake of this challenge, you can do the free trial. Another one that I've seen recommended before, at least it's really popular, is called Asana Rebel. So it's Asana Rebel. And again, it's free with probably a free trial and then in-app purchases. There's a lot of yoga apps that work with the iPhone, the iPad, and the Apple TV though. So if you know of one, you know, recommend it, to us on Twitter, I suppose. And we'll share that with readers. Or just search the app store on the Apple TV or wherever you want to do this. And then the one thing that I would say is that if you only care about it for the sake of this activity challenge and unlocking the achievements from your Apple Watch, YouTube has sessions that last longer than 15 minutes that are free to watch. And so you can figure it out that way.
Or if you want to cheat, you could just start a yoga workout and go for a run.
Oh, look at you. I wasn't going to say that, but you sure could. There is in my Yoga Studio app that I use on the Apple TV, there is one video that is, the yoga pose is like laying on the floor and closing your eyes and doing nothing for like 30 minutes. Like, so that counts. it is a system. You're not going to burn many calories that way, but
that's what I'm going to do for 15 minutes. I'm just going to sit there and do nothing.
Yeah. I forget what it's called. It's got a name too. It's like Dead Fish or something. but it's that's not what it's called. It's something like that. But you would feel very relaxed afterwards. Like it plays like Zen music and everything. So there you go. And then the final thing I want to mention this week is that the 9-to-5 Mac Daily podcast has been on a hiatus for about 3 or 4 weeks now. And even before that, I was only managing to put out like 3 episodes a week at most. And then I had an episode last month where I had shingles, which I only thought old people got. But the doctor said, yes, that's shingles. It was a weird rash. And I took some medication after that. And the advice was to try and relax and not be as stressed. So one of the things I decided to do upon returning is to distribute work a little bit better. And so Chance Miller is a colleague of ours. He's never done podcasts before. But today on June 19th, I handed the reins over to Chance Miller to host 9-to-5 Mac Daily. And I think you'll get back to 5 episodes a week, and it won't be like a big gap anymore. And he did his first episode today. I listened to it. I think he does a very good job. And just like with me, his first episode is better than my first episode. But just like with me, I think everyone should give him a chance and subscribe. Stay subscribed if you already are.
Take a chance and chance.
There you go. And as with anything else, experience and practice makes perfect. And so I think you know, you'll like what you hear, you know, if not now, you know, soon. I've been happy with 9to5 Mac Daily. Like from the start, it had a pretty good launch number of subscribers, and every month it has more subscribers. And that was part of the burden, was like, this thing's doing well and I'm not able to do it like I want
justice,
to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was like if it was just like a dead podcast, I wouldn't feel bad about just sunsetting it. But it keeps growing, so I can't. But now Chance is taking over, and I think he's going to do a great job. So if you're already subscribed, search for 9to5 Mac Daily in your podcast app, whether it's Apple Podcast or Overcast or whatever client, and give it a shot. Give Chance a chance, like you said. And with that being said, we'll be back next week. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at ApolloZach. Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZAMayo.
You can also email us at happyhour@nfmac.com. And we'll see everyone next week. Bye.
Bye.